This month marks the anniversary of a German business that opened its doors on the waterfront in our Honolulu in 1849. Heinrich Heckfeld was the entrepreneur whose companies would be taken over by American factors. Amfac was one of the big five in Hawaii's business scene. All that remains of that German history is a historic gate in a shady mini park across from the Aloha Tower. Here to talk about that artifact is Dennis Sell, the Honorary Counsel for Germany.
I think most people do not know or remember that Hawaii has a quite interesting German history. In the 1850s, German mercantile business people came from northern Germany, more or less by coincidence, to partake in the boom in whaling and later in the boom in sugar. Some of these people, their names are still visible in town. One of them is Eisenberg.
Or as
we would say, Eisenberg. Another, of course, is Pflüger. There are a couple of other places where you can still find some traces of German influence here, some street names that are not so well known, as, for instance, the Von Hamm Street.
Where's that?
It's in Pacific Heights, I think. Yeah. There are a couple more. There are some bridges named after Germans, but really the German influence here is almost eradicated. It's not celebrated and it's not visible to, you know, the unknowing eye. What I'm trying to do is to at least save the probably most prominent structure in Honolulu that represents German history, and that is the Heckfeld Gate, which sits at what is known as Walker Park, right across from Aloha Tower and adjacent to the Topa Tower. Most people, if you ask them if they know the Heckfeld Gate, will tell you that they don't. When you then describe where it is, everybody's seen it. It's that greenish, beautiful wrought iron gate that sits in this park right opposite of the fountain. And unfortunately, it's been sitting there 45 years or so, and it's rusting. It's only a few feet from the ocean, and I would love to preserve it.
So what do we need to do?
We need to collect some money. It'll cost us about $50,000 to dismount it and sandblast it and then recoat it with a special kind of paint. And to do that, I've been working for about a year and a half to get a permit, which I now have. And I am now trying to collect some money.
So tell us about Mr. Heinrich Heckfeld and how his business came to be on that waterfront.
So Heinrich Heckfeld is an amazing person. From everything I could gather, he was born in near Bremen, northern Germany. His parents were poor laborers, and somehow he managed to get a seafarer's education. He, as soon as he turned 16, went on board ship and traveled throughout the world as a ship worker. I don't really know what exactly he did, but over time he made a captain, and his explorations went further and further. The trip that's most meaningful was the one where he was sailing from Germany to China via Mexico, and he shipwrecked in the Philippines. His ship was loaded with gold and very valuable items, also some sandalwood and other things. Miraculously, the staff survived, and so did the cargo. And he then managed to get another ship to sail all this stuff back to Bremen. And he landed in Hawaii on that return trip. He was so impressed that he sent messages back to Bremen and said, here is a major opportunity. We got to come to Hawaii and start business here. Only that nobody listened. And so he went back to Bremen, now pretty much a broke guy because he didn't sell his stuff. And he had to start over. He did that within a year. And by 18, this shipwrecking happened in 1847. By 1849, he was back in Hawaii with a fully loaded ship and started business at Queen Street.
I mean, that's incredible to think that, you know, this month we're marking, you know, the time when he opened his doors because he wanted to be here, be a part of this community.
That's right. October 1st, 1849. He opened his store at Fourth Street. He then purchased a store that he previously had rented. The company then profited from the whaling boom for the first 10 years, and then soon after got into sugar. And sugar really propelled Hockfeld into another sphere. They initially started the shipping of sugar to the mainland, but then quickly got into what was called factoring. And factoring is nothing else than to buy the accounts receivable from the plantation and get that as a discount, and then sell the receivables to the people that got the sugar from the plantations. So they basically inserted themselves in the middle, which was a very common practice at the time. It's almost like banking. Their arms then reached to back to Europe, to other countries in Europe, and of course to the mainland U.S. as well as Russia.
And there was another famous name in sugar, Klaus Spreckels, right?
Klaus Spreckels, yeah, he was probably mightier than anyone else in this industry. Spreckels, not directly related to Hockfeld, and I haven't been able to figure out if these two guys actually ever interacted. To my best knowledge, Spreckels was a very private person and did not really get into the German community, which was on Oahu, whereas Spreckels was really more in Maui. However, Spreckels was very involved with the royal family and very influential in politics in Hawaii. And then later reinvented the sugar industry altogether in California by not using sugar cane, but the root, sugar root, and became incredibly rich.
Mr. Hockfeld, though, his, I guess, success in Hawaii unfortunately did not last because the German, well, his assets, I guess, got seized. He lost that, right?
This is probably the most interesting aspect of the whole story as far as I'm concerned, because the German community that came here in the 1850s and 60s and Hockfeld really got entangled in 1914 with World War I events. Obviously, they were not part of any kind of warfare, or I'm not even sure they were sympathizing with the imperial government in Germany that waged the war on the rest of Europe and by 1917, America. But Hockfeld's nephew at that point in the 1910s was Johann Hockfeld, who was the consul for Germany in Honolulu. And at the same time, German imperial ships were chased out of the Pacific by the Japanese. Interestingly enough, the Japanese at that time were allies with the U.S. And so we had a lot of German ships here, and stuff started happening. Loyalty questions came up amongst the Hawaiians. Initially, the Germans were really welcome, the German sailors that landed here fleeing from the Japanese. But over time, and as the war got more gruesome, the favor pendulum swung in the other direction. And by 1917, it was decided that Hockfeld's company had to be dissolved. There was an entity called the Alien Property Custodian. They deemed any German property to be unworthy in the United States. And at that time, Hawaii, of course, was still a territory, but had been moved so close after the abolishment of the kingdom to the U.S. that Germany was no longer welcome. So the custodian took the company, dissolved it, and sold it to its competitors.
And that later became
AmFac.
AmFac.
American Factors.
Right. And his store later became Liberty House. And, you know, it just that history, that thread, but it was his success as a businessman here in this community.
Correct. Yeah. So the Liberty House story is that another person related to Hockfeld, all of these Germans were ultimately somewhat related because they all came from Bremen. So B.F. Ehlers is the original store in Fourth Street that then existed for quite some time as a clothing garment store. As the American factors were put in place of Hockfeld, B.F. Ehlers became Liberty House. At the same foul swoop, basically.
That's great
and,
history.
Yeah. Ehlers was related, I think it was a nephew of Hockfeld.
That was Dennis Sell, Honorary Consul for Germany in the island, spotlighting and musing about the German connection in our history. October is a big deal for Germany. Yesterday it marked its national holiday, Reunification Day, uniting East and West. And this weekend actually may be the final Oktoberfest event here in the islands. It's at the Kaohumana Organic Farms in Waianae, and Dennis Sell was planning to go. For links to read more about this historic gate, head to our website.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributors Chaminade University and Hastings and Pleadwell, a communication company. Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from the Hawaii Association of Independent Schools, with more than 100 private schools across the islands to help different types of learners. More about the Find a School feature at hais.us.
You are back with The Conversation. In a nod to all things German, we explore how a new arts group, Hawaii Arts Lab, is taking some risks with German composer Robert Schumann's Tale of the Heart and Heartbreak. It's entitled Dicta Liebe. It's a man's take on a breakup. But as they say, there are always two sides of a story.
I will not hate, although my heart is torn. I saw you in my dreams, and saw the blackness and dark void of your.
Dicta Liebe, Descent into Love, will open at a new hotspot, the Entrepreneur Sandbox in Kaka'ako next to the medical school. The twist on this performance is that it'll be performed in English, German, and Hawaiian with new commissioned pieces and will include a woman's perspective. We sat down with artistic director Maka'i Nash to find out about this buzz on the new production.
We're looking at doing experiential things. So when you walk through that door, that's when your experience with us starts. It's not you wait for the curtain to go up. So it's different in all those ways and even more because we're adding multiple art forms together all at the same time.
So you really want to push the envelope here.
I want to push it as far as we possibly can go, yeah.
And so tell us about this first production.
This first production is called Dicta Liebe. It's Songs of Love, and it's an old, old song cycle from 1840, and it was written by Robert Schumann, and he wrote this, I don't know, breakup cycle that is so reverent because, I mean, some of the songs are 30 seconds long and they're angry and then they're reverent and then they are reliving a memory and then they are happy, kind of what happens when we are really going through a difficult breakup. But we never hear from her. We've never heard from her. So what we're doing is we've commissioned four new songs, Hawaiian Mele, that we are inserting into the cycle as her response to what he's saying.
So you're doing a little experimentation here.
Just a little bit, yes.
But that's neat that you've commissioned new work.
Commissioned brand new work. And it's actually the first Hawaiian art song cycle ever created. And a cycle is just a group of songs that either go together or tell a story. So it's kind of exciting. And we have Pomaika'i Lyman, who's the granddaughter of Auntie Genoa Keawe, singing the four songs. It's going to be great. And Jace Zaplan from the university wrote them.
And so you're launching this also at a new venue.
Yes.
Talk about that.
Entrepreneur's Sandbox is a really cool venue owned by Box Jelly, or at least run by Box Jelly. And it has, I don't know, 60-foot ceilings, 100-foot ceilings, windows on all sides. It's in Kaka'ako, right next to the medical school. And it's just a perfect space. I took an opera singer in there to go look at it, maybe 3 months ago, and she started singing in it, and it just rang like crazy. So it has beautiful, beautiful acoustics, and they are very amenable to having lots of performances in there, and it's just a great location. I mean, Kaka'ako is that new happening.
Yes, it's hip.
Happening place,
it's
yeah.
Edgy.
Mm-hmm.
And now a new performing space.
Yes, among many, you know, Impact Hub is also doing something with their space, but I think this one's going to get a lot of play. So it's really nice.
So tell us more about this production, though. I mean, did you have to get any special permission to play around with the storyline or what?
Thank God, no. Robert Schumann's luckily been gone for many, many years. So all we did was we just kind of looked at it. And, you know, music and art has kind of been very misogynistic, right, for centuries, not really giving the woman the chance to speak and to respond. So we thought it would be nice to finally have her come in. And the whole thought behind it is that if we take it to another city or if we take it to another performance, a different singer will come in and sing four different songs. And that'll be her story. So what we've done is we've crafted the story of the woman who's going to sing it. So that's her response to what this breakup. Because the breakup is luckily nebulous enough that you don't really know what happened. This is Pomekai's story a little bit, you know, and how she feels about things and how she thinks about things. So it's great. And if we go somewhere else, maybe it'll be four jazz songs. If we go somewhere else, maybe it'll be four Baroque songs.
But she's got a lovely voice.
She's got a fantastic voice. We're so lucky to have her.
Yeah, I think the last time I saw her, she was at the Iolani Palace Throne Room.
Oh,
and
beautiful.
It was on a night tour, and it was just an incredible evening. But I can see she's going to do some magic for this production.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, and there's going to be a dancer as well, dancing, and there's going to be a small art exhibition, which is part of the experience when you're waiting for the show to start.
Now, when you say art exhibition, is it tied into this theme as well?
Yes. Which is not hard, luckily, because almost everything is about love anyways in life. So whether it's breakup or being in love. Yeah.
And so when you start a new theater group or a performance group or whatever you want to call it, an arts group, what about the funding? And is it just getting a bunch of kindred spirits in the room, a bunch of creative people, and they just go kind of nuts or what?
Yeah, it's a good question, but it's actually a funny story because when we started it, we looked at the grant process and we were told, you're not going to get any grants this first year. So what we ended up doing was writing a grant just to get the puzzle pieces in place. And for a series called the Speakeasy Series, which we're going to start this year because we got the grant. And it was a shock to us and we had not planned it. So we had planned this entire season without it. And then we got the news that we got the grant. So we had to add four new productions into the season. And it's a good problem to have. You know, it means somebody's interested in what we're doing. And that's going to be a fun program as well.
Okay, so will it be at the Sandbox?
No, I can't tell you where it's at because it's going to be, it's a speakeasy. So it's one of those things we're going to give you that location 24 hours in advance. And the first one's December 6th, I believe. Yes. And you can buy tickets. It will be in town. We won't truck you out to Haleiwa.
Okay, but now what about for the neighbor islands? I mean, are you going to go to the neighbor islands?
Absolutely, yeah. That's why we're called the Hawaii Arts Lab. We definitely want to travel to the other islands. So then that just requires applying for those grants, you know, the family foundations in Maui and the state foundation for culture and arts here as well. It's just a matter of growing into it and not trying to get there too fast.
And now, as far as the launch for this space, I mean, your performance is going to christen, I would imagine, that facility then, right?
Surprisingly, they've already had a number of events there.
No kidding.
Yeah, Improv Hawaii did one of their events there, and there's been a couple of others that have been there.
So it's kind of soft opening, I guess.
It's kind of a soft opening, but they are officially launching October 10th, and we are going to be October 18th, 19th, and 20th. They have projection, they have audio already in it. Because we're doing classical voice is always unamplified. And with Pomaika'i, I don't think there's going to be much of an issue because it's a rather shallow space, but it's just very tall. And I think the resonance is going to carry all the way through. And we're bringing a piano into it as well. So it'll be a beautiful, beautiful sound in there. It's concrete and wood and tall ceilings and windows, so.
And it's grand.
It's grand, yeah, and brand new.
And so, gosh, as far as then other groups that, let's say, might want to take advantage of this facility, I mean, how does that work for performance fees and I don't know?
Yeah, you just have to get in touch with the facility manager at Entrepreneur Sandbox, and they can give you all the details. But they have really fair rates and very easy to work with, and they've been a dream, quite honestly, so far.
Okay, so your grant was able to cover all of that then?
The grant doesn't cover this opening launch. We have a couple of other grants for this one, but the grant does our Speakeasy series.
Okay,
yeah.
All right. So then what about as far, did you have to do a GoFundMe campaign to kind of get this production off the air, basically, or off the grant?
Yeah, like a kind of a personal one, right? So we had to go and we did apply for some grants, and we did receive grants for this as well. And then it's just a little bit of, we've had a lot of luck with, because I guess we're new with vendors gifting things to us. you know, for that exchange on our program and such. So we have a lot of things that we're lucky enough that we don't have to pay for right now. And we're glad about that. So we have all the alcohol for the bar taken care of and the pianos taken care of. And it's just a matter of now getting people in the seats.
Okay. All right. Fledgling group promising to push the envelope.
Yes. Always.
and we're going to love it, right?
Yes, absolutely. And right. I look forward to seeing you there.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Makai Nash studied at McGill University and trained in Vienna, Paris, and Italy. He returned home after a 20-year career abroad as an operatic vocal coach and pianist. Dicta Liba runs October 18th, 19th, and 20th. For links about times and tickets, head to our website.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributors Bush Consulting, Island Insurance, and Sacred Hearts Academy.
Joining us for today's reality check is political and opinion editor Chad Blair of Honolulu Civil Beat. The online news service has a story about the breakup of the Damon Trust. Good morning, Chad.
Good morning, Catherine, and happy 10th day of the pledge drive.
Yes.
Hope you guys are holding up okay.
Yes, happy Friday. Happy Aloha Friday. You know, you and I have both done stories, so many stories about
sure.
Bishop Estate and then the end of Campbell Estate, but Damon Estate, this should be interesting because there's a lot of family feuding.
Yeah, it doesn't get as much attention. I don't think as many people in Hawaii know about it unless they've lived here a long time. Even I thought I knew of pretty much a lot, but no, it turns out Kirsten Downey's story, which is what I'm reporting on today, is really a great deep dive back into this really a legacy estate, the Damon Estate, the Damon Trust. And the reason why it's in the news is because while it was once valued at $900 million, boy, that's almost $1 billion, now the estate's trustees are seeking to approve a settlement and pay out something like 30 beneficiaries. There's about $15 million left, and that hearing is set for November 1st. But yes, there has been some infighting. There are a couple of dissident beneficiaries. Litigation has long surrounded the estate of Samuel Mills Damon. Remember that name, Samuel Mills Damon?
Yes, yes. And, you know, I think a lot of folks associate it with Manawa Gardens.
Well, that as well, they should, because when he passed from the scene, I think it was back in 1924, he donated the area, the Ahupua'a of Mauna, which is huge. I mean, it includes Tripler, Mapunapuna, Salt Lake, parts of the international airport. But yeah, absolutely, Mauna Gardens, which all of us recognize, 9,000 acres total. And that was an enormous gift of philanthropy from Samuel Mills Damon when he left the scene. But still, money remains, and infighting to see if they can divide up that money peacefully. We'll hope that there will be a peaceful conclusion on that.
Yeah, and Samuel Damon had a link to the monarchy.
Absolutely. Involved with, he was a financier, by the way, by trade, and he was tied with Princess Bernice Pauahi Bishop. Of course, she of the Bishop Estate Kamehameha School's fame. In fact, that is where the money came from. The bulk of her estate went to Kamehameha Schools, but not all of it. And so that is the tie-in there. He even had a role, according to Kirsten's story, advising Queen Liliuokalani, in fact, or encouraging her to give up the throne back when the 1893 overthrow happened. So he is an historic figure that really has been very instrumental in the way modern Hawaiian history has shaped out.
Now, as far as the holdings of the trust, I guess, you know, we don't know what's going to happen, do we?
No, the litigation has been something that has surrounded the case, and as can be expected with any huge pile of money that is when that's involved. But that's something that is scheduled, as I indicated, for November 1st. I should just mention, by the way, Kirsten also has this in her story. Remember the movie The Descendants, the George Clooney
yes.
film? Yeah, the one that was filmed here. And, of course, that was a famous book from Kawi Hemmings, the daughter of Fred Hemmings, the former state senator. Well, really, in many ways, The Descendants is sort of the tale, the fictional tale of what happened with the Damon family. Not word for word, but that's something that Kirsten brings up that I think helps the average reader and listener kind of tie in to understand why this is so important.
Yeah, and the Damon story, too, they've had some tragedy as well over the years.
Yeah, and I can't go into it too much, but I can tell you that Samuel Mills Damon's son was killed in a fight. He himself, it appears that he may have been losing it near the end, got kind of crazy, according to some people who knew. So as with any great family, there is sadness, there is tragedy. But you ought to read it. It's a terrific story up on our site today.
Okay, thanks so much, Chad. The Damon thanks. Drama Saga. We'll see what happens November 1st.
Okay.
We were talking to Chad Blair, political and opinion editor at Honolulu Civil Beat. Again, read that story online at civilbeat.org.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Piano Planet, home of Steinway, also featuring Roland, Yamaha, and Kauai Pianos, located on Nimitz Highway in the Na Lama Kukui Building. Learn more at pianoplanethawaii.com.
Maui's brush fires triggered evacuations this week, and that got us wondering if a planned relocation project for endangered birds that was planned for this month would be impacted. Fortunately, not. Now, next week, members of the Maui Forest Bird Recovery Project will begin catching the birds to begin the move. That process involves attaching radio transmitters on the rare Maui parrotbill, a type of Hawaiian honey creeper. It's to keep track of the birds. Here's a rebroadcast of a conversation we had this summer with Hannah Mounts, the project coordinator.
Maui Forest Bird Recovery Project is trying to basically prevent the extinction of forest birds on Maui. So we work on recovering the kiwiqiu, which is the most endangered forest bird on Maui, and we have been putting radio transmitters out on Hawaii Amakihi to be able to track them around the forest, and it's kind of a trial for when we're going to put the more endangered bird out in that same forest habitat and be able to track them as well.
So how do you actually put these transmitters on the birds? Explain that process.
Yeah, they're very tiny. They have to weigh less than 3 to 5% of the bird's weight. So they're very, very tiny, and they go around their legs with an elastic loop harness, and they sit in the middle of their back, and the birds basically can't take them off. And then we follow them around with handheld antennas, and, you know, we get different locations on where they are and then try to get a visual on the actual bird.
That's amazing. I mean, how long have we been doing this?
The technology gets better every single year. I work on very small dinky birds, so we had to wait a long time until these transmitters could get small enough that we could put them on small birds. You know, bigger animals, we've been able to, you know, you can do really fancy stuff like satellite tracking and things like that, but we can't put something that big on these small birds, so we have to rely on just being able to track them on land.
Now, I recall doing a story with the shark tagging, and Carl Meyer out at Coconut Island and his staff, they actually put satellite tags on big tiger sharks, very big tiger sharks. But same thing, they talked about how the technology has gotten better and better, and they actually have a critter cam on a shark. But I imagine with the bird, it's a little different because, like you said, they're so tiny.
Kiwiqiu weigh between 17 to 25 grams. I mean, these guys are tiny, and so you can't put something very big on them. And so as the technology improves, though, basically it's the battery that weighs a lot. And so as it improves, you're able to get a longer duration. So like some people have put transmitters on dragonflies. So, I mean, they're super tiny, but they don't last very long. These transmitters that we're putting on now with current technology, we're going to be able to get them to last about 25 to 60 days, depending on the bird's weight.
And describe this bird for our listeners who aren't familiar with it.
Sure. So kiwiqiu, it's kind of like the woodpecker roll on Maui. So they have a really big curved bill, and they rip apart bark and branches and things like that to find invertebrates and grubs that are inside. It's a yellow-green bird, and some people look at it, it's a little bit smaller than a lovebird, and with that same like giant bill. So it's very unique. And there aren't any other honey creepers like it.
Okay, so there's a very small population on Maui.
So our project is focused on that species because they're the most critically endangered on Maui. Current population estimates less than 300 individuals, and that's a global population because they're a Maui endemic.
And so is it a particular area of Maui where they're found?
They're currently found on the windward slopes of Maui, everywhere from TNC's Waikamoi Preserve, which is a windward rainforest area that people can access. And they're found there all the way across that windward slope above 5,000 feet. But very remote, very few people experience them. But we're actually moving them to the leeward side of the island this October, which is really exciting because they're isolated up there on that windward slope because that's the only good forest we have left on Maui. And they probably don't really want to be there. When you look at the fossil record, they were found island-wide, but we just don't have forest and disease-free habitat for them island-wide anymore. So they're just restricted to this little 36 square kilometer area. So we're going to move them. We've been doing forest restoration. We're going to move them to the leeward side. We're going to support them and hope that we can establish a second population on the other side of the volcano.
That's pretty exciting stuff, though, when you try and translocate a group of birds.
Yeah, super exciting, super scary. We're putting very little tiny endangered birds in boxes and flying them via helicopters from one side of the mountain to the other, letting them go in a koa forest instead of an ohia forest. But we're losing them on the windward side. Their population is continuing to decline, and they're in protected habitat. It's already fenced. You know, the ungulates are out, and until we get landscape level management for introduced small mammals or disease control, which would be mosquito management, there's nothing else we can do for them on that side. So we've got the opportunity to give them another chance on the other side.
And ungulates, we're talking pigs.
Pigs, deer, goats, yep.
Okay. So, gosh, so hopefully they'll adapt to this other home that they'll be moved to.
Yeah, we hope so. Historically, they were found in this area that we're moving them to. But of course, that individual bird that we're going to move has never been in that habitat before. So we're constructing aviaries that we're going to put the birds in for 1 to 2 weeks. They're going to learn how to eat out of feeders that we provide live food for them and get them familiar with that area. And then we do what we call a soft release, whereas after they've been in the aviary for 1 or 2 weeks, then we open the doors. And then we're going to be able to track them with those transmitters to see how they're interacting with the environment.
And then do we have any capability to do a critter cam at all with these birds?
Too small, way too small. It'd be so cool, though, to be able to see them, like, foraging and digging through bark and things like that. But, yeah, no, these transmitters are so tiny. What we can do is we can put game cameras up on the feeding stations. And so when the bird actually comes back to the feeding station, we can then take photos of who's coming back and look at what they're doing.
Okay. And then what about the threats to these birds?
Right. So the threats to these birds are very similar to all the forest birds across Hawaii. We've lost most of our forest on all the islands, and so forest loss and continued degradation is big. But even in the forest areas that are left, our current threats that we're facing are the constant influx of new introduced plants and animals, so invasive species, and then the invasive species that are here, like mammalian predators that are predating on these birds. And then we also have the unique challenge of avian disease. So we have introduced mosquitoes and introduced disease, and that limits almost all of our native forest birds to high elevation areas, which makes recovery a little bit more challenging.
What makes you so passionate about this type of work with these birds?
Yeah, it's great. I actually came to Hawaii as an intern on this same project 13 years ago. And one thing that's great about Hawaii is the islands are so small that we really can make a difference. So, you know, Maui is being very progressive with fencing, and we have lots of really strong partnerships and moving forward with forest restoration that we can really see like a bright future for these guys going forward.
And is there any bright spot on the horizon for funding?
Yeah, funding is always an issue, and people always ask how they can help. And I always hate saying like, well, funding. But it is a big thing where, you know, we want people who live here to have ownership over, you know, the land and the island and be able to, you know, to give back. And something that's been really great for us is we've been basically a forest restoration project the last few years while we've been getting this reintroduction site ready, and it's working. So people see that, and they actually see this forest that's being rebuilt as a hope spot. And that has been, you know, able to get us additional funding where people want to sponsor trees and they want to volunteer and things like that. We're a nonprofit, so we have a very diverse funding stream from both state, federal, private, and nonprofit funding.
And I know we had some scientists in here who were working with endangered snails, and I think we had Lonesome George. You know, they had names for all their snails. You have names for your birds, too?
Sometimes. We try not to name them, but it's funny. Their color band combos kind of lend themselves to names, and so sometimes when people are in the field, they do give the different pairs just like names, like the Chico's pair or the Cubs or something like that, because they know based on their colors who they're talking about.
Okay, all right. So we're rooting for the team, right?
Yep. It's a really exciting next few months. This has been 13 years coming, and moving these first birds is going to tell us a lot, and we're going to really know how they're going to react to that landscape. We're going to know how we're going to forward in the future. So it's going to be a busy few months, and yeah, we'd love people to keep in touch with the project and follow us online, and we'll try to, you know, post lots of updates and keep people in the loop of what's going on.
Save the forest, save the birds. We were talking to Hannah Mounts, the coordinator of the Maui Forest Bird Recovery Project. Members of her group went out last week for a scouting trip, and next week, Wednesday, a dozen will actually start the process of catching the birds and then relocating the entire population to another part of the island. Hey, thanks for joining us here on The Conversation. I'm Catherine Cruz, back over to Pledge Central with Bill Dorman and Derek Malama.